I'm speaking today with State Representative Garnett Coleman, who represents the 147th House District here in Harris County. Representative Coleman, you've been in the House a long time. From my perspective on the outside, this last session was pretty awful. How would you classify it?
It was awful. Because the results are what matter. And the result was bad public policy passed for women, for children, for the elderly, and for everyday Texans. An example would be the sonogram. We call the sonogram bill, the invasive vaginal sonogram, and that's just unnecessary. But it's sort of like, you know, somebody flicking their teeth at you, leaving a $5 billion hole in public education, which is so important to the future of our state, and then leaving a $5 billion hole in Medicaid. But this is state money. And then not using the rainy day fund to mitigate a piece of those holes to make sure they're filled in when we go back into session in 2013. And those were really, really bad things for the elderly in nursing homes or home care under Medicaid. That's what we spend most of the money on. It's not children in their health care through the Medicaid program, but it's the elderly and disabled through nursing home care and home care for under Medicaid. And that's where we, and rightly so, these, you know, like Ronald Reagan said, shoot, you know, the most vulnerable among us. Well, they don't want the most vulnerable to be served. They're not using Ronald. Matter of fact, Ronald Reagan today would be considered liberal.
It's kind of a scary thought, isn't it?
It is a scary thought.
Let's talk first about Medicaid then. As you said, the budget underfunded Medicaid by $5 billion, and it's sort of the worst-kept secret around that is what the rainy day fund is going to be used for in the next session, to fill that hole in. But there were some other significant changes made to that are coming to Medicaid. The state has applied for some waivers, yeah, regarding how it uses Medicaid, some of which you support. Talk to me,
right,
about that.
Well, let's start with the 11, we call it the 1115, it's the 1115 waiver, because it's the only one that's been applied for and approved,
okay,
but it's called the transformation waiver. And what it does is it takes hospital, this is used Harris County. Harris County Hospital District gets something called upper payment limit money from the federal government. It's a lump sum of dollars based on the difference between what Medicaid charges and what Medicare charges. So that amount in between, Medicare being the upper payment limit and then what Medicaid pays the hospital district, we get the cash in between. So they send a check. And then that money has been shared with other hospitals in the region, like Memorial Hermann, HCA, now Texas Children's, St. Luke's, Methodist, St. Joseph's. So California had done a waiver to the CMS, the federal government, to be allowed to get front-loaded with some money and match additional dollars. Well, we have county dollars that are used for indigent health care. And so there are other dollars out there in the whole state that can be matched. And that allows us to turn a $14 billion program that would owe to a $29 billion program. And so that money will come into different regions around the state. Well, I worked with the White House to get it, to shape it. And so I was for it because I got the stuff that I thought was good for our state in the waiver. And so those things are Medicaid lookalikes for mental health, for diabetes, for HIV and AIDS, or AIDS, and then for preventative care and intervention. And so the concept of the waiver should actually do very good things for the regions. Now, the hospitals themselves, they're not exactly happy about it, but they don't create the money. It's the public sector that creates the actual dollar.
But the state of Texas is also, or at least as I recall, Rick Perry has advocated for turning Medicaid into a block grant.
Yes, and they're still advocating for that.
What does that mean?
Well, what it means is, and it really goes with the whole Republican idea of taking Medicare and Medicaid and turning it into a block grant, and they would take the expenditures on Medicaid and Medicare now. They would turn that into, freeze it, and turn it into a pot of money. And each state would get a pot of money based on those dollars, the aggregate dollars. The problem is the pot of money doesn't grow. And if the state grows, then we got a problem. The other is their intention would be to end the entitlement, or what we would call the guarantee for certain people to receive to get their health care paid for. And principally, this is a federal goal, so it's about ending the entitlement in Medicare.
So the idea is not to try to curb or contain health care costs by delivering it more efficiently or more effectively, but by essentially saying...
They claim that, but that's not what they're doing.
But essentially by saying, we're not going to spend more than this no matter what.
That's correct. And I'll give you an example. When TANF, or AFDC, welfare, was block granted, we were a state that didn't spend a lot of money. So we had both a welfare aid to families with dependent children block grant, and then they did the child care block grant. Well, we got capped at the level of our historical spending, which was very low, and we were a growing state. New York, on the other hand, got capped at their level of historical level of spending, which was very high. But they're losing population, and we're gaining population, and they right now, that creates a boatload of money for them, and we're sucking wind because we have more people than we had before that might be eligible. So that's a real problem with a block grant, is if it does not grow with the population, whereas a matching program grows, the population increases, that person that's eligible in that population increase gets services. And for seniors and the disabled, well, you know, quite frankly, everybody, and I'm going to need it. I want my Medicare. I mean, because older people get sick, and that's just the long and short of it.
All right. The other thing associated with Medicaid that, of course, has been in the news recently is the women's health program, mm-hmm. In which we were getting a 9-to-1 match on federal dollars for this program. Mm-hmm. The legislature, or the Republicans in the legislature, attempted to bar Planned Parenthood, which is one of the biggest provider, the mm-hmm. biggest provider mm-hmm. of the women's health program services, because it's affiliated with clinics that do abortion.
Mm-hmm.
The federal government has said, no, you can't do that, and now this money is...
No, the federal government says you can. It's the state government says that you can't. They changed the definition of affiliate.
The federal government says you can't bar the...
But bar Planned Parenthood.
So, I mean, what's going on with
this? Well, first of all, let me give you some history. The first person to carry and pass the bill in 1999 was me. It was vetoed by George W. Bush. It was me and Corona. From Dallas. Then we passed it again in 2001 as a part of the larger Medicaid bill, me and Judith Zaffarini. It was then vetoed by Perry. It then came probably 1995. It was passed with the language, the affiliate language in it, but the affiliate language definition was not the same as it has become. So there wasn't much happening in that regard in terms of blocking Planned Parenthood from being able to provide women's health services waiver services. But in that language, you could not refer a limited income woman who received those services to anybody who performed abortions. That includes private physicians. And so since a lot of African-American doctors provide care to people who are poor, that meant that those people could not be sent to that doctor because they provide abortions in their offices. And so this is not about just Planned Parenthood. It's about it's attack on Planned Parenthood, but it also affects individual OBGYNs that believe that safe and available abortion is something that that is a medical practice that they believe is important. And so when I filed my bill this session, it was it had a change in it because there's a physician I've known my whole life. You know, it's one of my little bit behind my father, OBGYN, actually has his office here near downtown. He said it's not fair that if someone has a problem where they've been screened and they have cervical cancer, they can't go to him for the cervical cancer. They can't be referred because he provides abortion services as an individual doctor. So it really is about more than Planned Parenthood. They provide a lot, most of the services under the Women's Health Services Program, but an individual doctor could do the same thing. But this is just pure politics. And the loser are limited income women, poor women who unfortunately happen to be black and brown. And it's a very important thing that we get this program back. But how we get it back, I don't know, because the waiver has to be applied for by the state. If the state does not apply to the federal government to keep the waiver, or the federal government says, no, if you're going to ban this provider, these providers, we will not renew the waiver. And that's pretty much where we are right now. The state changing the definition of affiliate that knocks out all providers in terms of being referred to by the Women's Health Services Program. If they provide abortions, they cannot see that patient at all.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about public education then. Mm-hmm. As you know, there have been multiple lawsuits filed mm-hmm. to try and once again force something to happen regarding public education. But, you know, it seems to me that the elephant in the room on this has always been the tax swap from 2006 which, you know, the tax cut that was mandated more or less by the last Supreme Court ruling wasn't even close to being paid for by the revenue sources that they came up with, primarily the business margins tax. Mm-hmm. We knew about it then. We were able to mask it for a while because we had surplus.
Well, they knew about it.
They certainly knew about it.
We knew that it didn't work.
Yeah.
Meaning me, Jim Dunham, Pete Gallego, Scott Hochberg, we laid out during that special session that there's a hole that would be created because the local taxes, the amount of money the legislature was putting in through these new taxes, the margins tax, the used car tax, and the cigarette tax, would not equal the tax cut, property tax cut that was done out in the local communities. And so now that we have what we call a structural shortfall, and it's permanently at $10 billion a biennium.
You know, what if anything, I mean, what's the end game on this? I mean, the Supreme Court's going to make some ruling, and it's going to, I mean, I don't know what they're going to do, but, you know.
But this is where, I just say where policymakers have a problem, and particularly those conservative policymakers who don't understand that their constituents actually attend public schools and that they really do need the dollars to have the appropriate instructors, you know, teachers that teach physics, that teach advanced math, that teach English, that they can't have an art class or all the extracurriculars if there's no money to pay for it. And, you know, a lot of people think, oh, let's go kick those people in their asses. You know, they're only black and brown people in public schools, and we're tired of paying for them. And then they look around, and their kids are in public schools, too. And when there's not enough money, it's not enough money for everybody. So the lawsuits would be helpful. And hopefully the judges make good decisions to say, Texas, you got to do these things. Because otherwise, we won't be able to increase revenue without a gun to our head, which will only come to the legislature's head through one of these suits on the adequacy of the funding of public education.
I mean, can the business margins tax be fixed, or do there have to be? I mean, what do you think needs to be done?
Well, first of all, the leadership, the people in charge, have put themselves in a box, and the reason being is they lowered the who was subject to the margins. They made it less businesses by increasing the amount of gross income that a business could earn to be subject to the margins tax. So now it's at $1 million. Anything under $1 million, they're not subject to the margins tax. So that took a lot of people out of the businesses out of the equation. So that lowered the amount of money even further than the gap where the tax wouldn't be enough to offset the new taxes wouldn't be enough to offset the including the margins tax. Property tax. No, it's called a conundrum. It's called it doesn't fit. But I think people have to know this. I mean, and it's just true. These people who are leading, so-called leading Texas, they're not for public education. And so this the best way to dismantle something is to fund it inappropriately. That is, it goes beyond the legislative conundrum. It's about what people believe the future of this state and ultimately the future of this country should be. Because Texas is the incubator for the type of policy that is exported to the White House when there's a Republican in there and exported to all 50 states to be implemented. And that's what really folks don't know, is that we are, it's usually a small state that's one of the experimenters. No, it's us. We're the people that the policy, it's our state that the bad conservative fiscal policy that harms our future is being carried out and then exported to other states.
Well, in fact, there are people on the conservative policy side, the Texas Public Policy Foundation, who are claiming that we don't need to be spending more money on public education. It all goes to waste, I guess, is their opinion.
Well, the problem is, don't they understand that children are being born every day and growing and need to be in school, but the legislature didn't fund the new children that need to go to school? That's not more money in public education. That's money for children. Newly born and growing children. And so what they did was the legislature did not fund the enrollment growth. This didn't fund it. And so, you know, you can't do that. So to actually use this idea that we don't want to put more money into education, this isn't more money per child. This is funding the new children, you know, that are going to enroll in school.
As we speak today, the Justice Department is still reviewing the controversial voter ID legislation. I think everyone expects them to not pre-clear it. There's a separate lawsuit going on about that. You know, help people who maybe don't fully understand this understand. What is going to be the effect of the voter ID legislation if it does get implemented?
Okay. First of all, anyone who particularly first start off who's homeless, they won't have an ID and they won't be able to vote because they don't have a light bill. They don't have all the other IDs that are asked for under this bill that substitute for a driver's license. But there are many thousands of people, and I mean thousands and thousands, that don't have a driver's license or an ID card. And those individuals will be denied a vote because they don't have an ID card, a driver's license, or any other of the requested documents. And so what's fascinating about that is under voter ID law, you can walk a person to vote, can walk in to a polling place with their voter registration card, and that their vote would be considered no good until proven good through a process. And so this harms the elderly. It harms students in college because they won't have a light bill. They won't have, maybe not have a Texas driver's license. They may have another driver's
license. And if I can interrupt, student ID was not considered acceptable ID, but a concealed carry license is.
Yes. And so let's just put this what it is, what it's about. This is about suppressing the vote through the law. And suppressing the vote of the elderly, the young, the poor. Sound familiar? And so this is no different than state-sanctioned Jim Crow laws in a modern way by skimming off people who would vote Democratic so that their vote won't count. And so they go to the polling place, but their vote won't count. And so these are this is the reason why we believe that it disenfranchises, not that one reason alone, but the other reasons. It has a disproportionate impact on people who are citizens, who are protected by the Voting Rights Act in terms of their ability to cast their ballot and have it count for the candidate of their choice. And this is just certainly, it's clear to me that it violates. And I sent a letter to the Justice Department explaining why, interviewed with the Justice Department explaining why. I mean, and this was rolled out in some form or another in all 50 states. That's how important it is to the, I'm going to say conservatives, but it's truly Republicans. And there, we don't have ballot problems. We don't have people who shouldn't vote voting. And if there was a place where that's a problem, it's in mail ballots. And there's nothing about mail ballots in any of this law because Republicans use mail ballots, Democrats use mail ballots, but Republicans are more successful at sending mail ballots and getting their over 65s in particular to vote.
Also going on at this point, I mean, we now have maps to be used for this election. Mm-hmm. They're all still under litigation, of course.
Mm-hmm.
What is your opinion of the maps that the San Antonio court ultimately drew at the direction of the Supreme Court for the 2012 election?
I don't particularly care for them, meaning I don't like them. And the reason I don't like them is I didn't like the state's map that went through the legislative process and was signed by Governor Perry. This is substantially similar to that original map that was passed out of the House on the floor. In being so, it does not appropriately protect districts that are subject to the Voting Rights Act, nor does it appropriately create new districts based on the increase in population of Latinos and African Americans. And so this is a map that essentially the status quo exists. Now, there are people who can win seats. And some seats were put back as protected under the Voting Rights Act, but not as many as there should be. And then there are other seats that some of the population was skimmed down that puts the incumbent who may be in those voters who want to elect the representative of their choice who happens to be Latino, puts that district at risk for their choice to be defeated. I believe that the permanent map is extremely important because this is an interim map for 2012 elections. The permanent map would be for the 2014 elections because they're going to have to do a permanent map, the three-judge panel. And we'll be back in session in 2013, hopefully only tinkering with the edges of districts where people believe that it was all drawn wrong to begin with, and it doesn't change representation in a global sense. It just puts the right precincts in the right district because they better fit that district.
In 2009, Joe Strauss was elected Speaker of the House, largely with the support of Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
He ousted Tom Craddock.
Strong supporter of Joe Strauss.
You know, looking back, any regrets about that?
No. And the reason there aren't, because it was 76-74 when we in 2010, but and I would first of all, I never regret having more leaving Craddock there would have been that's just not right. I mean, that meant that there was a person that was malevolent, you know, towards the people that I represent. And so keeping him there was not a smart move. Neither was it a smart move for our members who had been elected, because they had not had a chance to be members of the legislature. And they needed to be members of the legislature. That's the only way they can learn. So they had to have an opportunity to learn how to be members of the legislature. Strauss being elected, he did do exactly what we asked him to do, which was give us our run. You know, allow us to bring our bills to the floor, give us our run in committee, do those things, give us some decent committee assignments. And we did that. One of our objectives the whole time was not about Strauss. It was about getting rid of Craddock. And we got rid of him. We did that. We beat him. We took out a sitting Republican tyrant speaker that was harming Texas with every year he was there. Now, we were defeated. We lost a lot of seats in 2010 primarily because of the use of race and bigotry. And that race and bigotry knocked us down to 49, because when people are saying states' rights, secession, and they're running and doing all of those policies, they really mean they're doing a double entendre. States' rights was the cry during segregation, that the segregationists, the people who want to divide folks by race, they used states' rights as the reason they could, so that the state had more parity with the federal government. The only time secession was ever even contemplated in anywhere, and it was during the Civil War, and the break was over slavery. These words have meaning. And so, you know, that was used all over the country, starting with the healthcare debate in the town hall meetings. That was the reason why it was a wave. We'd seen one of those before. 2002 was a wave. So that was what was generating the anti-democratic deal. So Strauss is there. You know, would it be better under another person? No. Because all of them are ratcheted down by the Republican establishment to do the bills that the Republicans are using to defeat Democrats.
Okay. And you have an opponent in this primary election, which is scheduled for May 29th, barring mm-hmm. anything unusual happening at this point. You know, when people do go to vote in this election, why should they vote to give you another term in the state house?
Well, this, first of all, I hope I do a good job. I do the best that I can to make sure that the people that live in District 147 are heard by this office, and that we actually forward their concerns. I believe that the things that people need, I've actually worked on and accomplished, and that's really important. Getting this 1115 waiver to include people where those services were cut in the state budget is a coup. And that shows that even with Republican leadership, if you understand, if one understands how to play the game, then you can do something for your constituents. I passed a suicide prevention bill that was tied to a bullying bill, because I thought that the most important thing was that children be sent for help with their parents if they have a problem that's identified by a teacher, whether it be bullying or anything else, and they show behavioral changes. That was extremely important. And there's some things that are kind of obscure but big. I mean, who would have ever thunk it that the bill that ended the ban on the corporate practice of medicine by physicians that I would pass? And I did. And I think that's good, because for rural hospitals and people who live in different, they don't have a ready access to physicians. It also saved 18% of the cost at the hospital district for providing care, 18% of the gross. So these are things that you know, I'm very proud of. There's so many other things. I actually can't remember them. But these are things that I think are important. I believe that I can continue through my chairmanship of the County Affairs Committee, through my service on the Public Health Committee, and on the Calendars Committee. I think that I can continue to work, actually accomplish something under these circumstances. And plus, you know, I come from an era where the people who were elected under single-member districts, the very first people in this city, people like John Whitmire, Mickey Leland, Anthony Hall, Sinfronia Thompson, you know, these are people who went to the legislature to challenge the establishment, who happened to be conservative Democrats. They've all turned into Republicans now. They came younger, of color, and there's totally new legislature. Well, unfortunately, we are back in 1972 and 1973, and it requires people who are not fearful of calling it as they see it and not afraid to push back on the leadership that's harming their constituents. So I will continue to fight on the principles that we believe in and the people that we represent, that I represent, that the leadership doesn't, and they don't want that. They don't want to help those individuals. So I'm going to be there to speak truth to power at every step of the moment. So I think I've done that. And that's the reason I hope that the people of the newly reconfigured District 147 will reelect me back to another term in the legislature.
State Representative Gardner Coleman, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Oh, you're welcome. My pleasure.